From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. It's Friday, and before we get into things today, I first want to wish all of us a happy birthday. This Sunday, December 3rd, is Illinois Statehood Day. It was 205 years ago that we were admitted into the Union, becoming the 21st state. The event, as you can tell, that gives our show its name. So once again, happy birthday, my fellow Illinoisans. Okay, on with the show. We begin, as ever, with our Friday Reporter Roundtable, in which we talk about what's been making headlines in different parts of the state. Today, we're focusing on the Quad Cities and the Metro East. Joining us now for that is Michelle O'Neill, news editor at our partner station, WVIK, Quad Cities Public Radio. Michelle, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much.
Also with us, Will Bauer, Metro East reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Will, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Brian, and happy Statehood Day.
Thank you. You as well. And listeners, you can join our conversation. We're on tape for the politics part of our show, the middle part of the show, but we're live now and at the end. So 800-222-9455 is the number to join us. 800-222-9455. All right, Will, I want to begin with you. Some downbeat news. There are layoffs coming to U.S. Steel's Granite City Works plant. How many people are we expecting to be affected by that?
Well, that's a really good question, and I wish I had a better answer, but there's kind of lots of unknowns and approximate numbers depending on who you ask. So the news this week was that U.S. Steel, the Pittsburgh-based parent company, had sent more than 1,000 notices to employees of layoffs because they were indefinitely shutting down the blast furnace where they make the steel. And some important context here to understand is that back in September, U.S. Steel said it would temporarily idle the furnace, and that September decision would lead to 400 temporary layoffs that would last less than 6 months. So Tuesday's decision was just making what was once thought to be temporary to be more permanent, and the confusion comes in how many workers will lose their jobs. So the company says they're thinking about 60% of that 1,000, so that'd be 600, will lose their jobs. The union is a little more optimistic, oddly enough, and they're saying that it's around 400 will lose their job. But of course, there's more than 1,000 notices sent. So if U.S. Steel wanted to, they could go that direction. So that was earlier this week. And yesterday, the Illinois Department of Labor said they would subpoena looking into U.S. Steel's action regarding mass layoffs. So that they're going to try to determine if the company violated the state law, and there's a similar federal law too that requires big employers to send at least 60 days notice if there are going to be large amounts of workers laid off. So if they were to have found that U.S. Steel violated state law, they would require the company to back pay for salaries and benefits along with some small fines. And this is kind of a whole series of events. You know, layoffs happen all the time kind of in Granite City over the few years that I've been paying attention to it. And it's a big deal for Granite City because the mill employs about 1,800 employees and town 27,000. So it's a big employer. Granite City is very much a steel town. Workers are generational. And kind of the economic and overall health and feel of the city centers around the mill. So if the mill takes a hit, it's a big deal for the rest of the city too.
You know, it's interesting because it's been a political football too. President Trump actually did a rally in Granite City relating to this steel mill, claiming, you know, that he was bringing it back, bringing the industry back. I know it's been a bit of a political football over the years as well.
Yeah, it absolutely has. He was there, like you said, in 2018. It's, you know, U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, a longtime labor leader, has definitely gotten involved, and she was the one that even asked the Illinois Department of Labor to look into it. And I know there's a lot of local reaction from the Republicans, Democrats who represent the area and the state legislature that are kind of upset just because, yeah, like I had said, it's a big deal for Granite City and the surrounding area because it employs so many people.
Interesting. Well, a story I'm sure you will continue to watch, and we will as well. Michelle O'Neill at WVAK, I want to bring you into the conversation now. You have some updates on the development of the new bridge for Interstate 80. And
yes.
As a reminder to listeners, we've talked about this on the show. There was some talk of possibly turning one of the old bridges into a bison habitat, a new national park in the form of a bridge. What's the story? What's going on with that?
All right, so Chad Pergracki is a name everybody knows around here as the founder of Living Lands and Waters, and he goes around and cleans up trash from big rivers, and he's been doing this for decades now. So he had this big idea that would, he thought, you know, bring tourists and get people who travel I-80 all the time to stop. And that was to put a bison on one half of the old, future old I-80 bridge just north of the Quad Cities. And the other half would be a bike lane, pedestrian path, and, you know, have amenities, right, for visitors. And so about, you know, 40 to 50,000 people signed a petition to make that happen. And he's been going around collecting pledges from people who would spend a bunch of money to make that happen. Well, as you know, the process of building an interstate bridge is very complicated, and you have both state departments of transportation involved and the federal department of transportation and the navigation folks too, the riverboat
Army
folks.
Corps. And, yeah.
Exactly. So for a few years, the bridge study team has, you know, at first they had seven options for building a new bridge, and definitely needs to be a new bridge there. The bridge that is there is 50 years old, which sounds relatively new, but, you know, the outside lanes a few years ago were shown to have some cracks and some problems. So it's very expensive to maintain and repair. So anyway, just recently, the bridge study team announced their preferred alternative, which is the one that will move forward from now on. And it is for what they call a companion bridges just to the west or downstream of the existing bridge. So they would build the first side of it before and have traffic continue on the current I-80 bridge. And then they would move all traffic to the new side and tear down the old or existing I-80 bridge. And that would have been the one.
I'm saying that, I'm not hearing where the bison are going to live in this plan.
In this plan, a bison bridge park, whether it would be a state park to begin with or eventually a national park, would not be possible.
Oh, well, that's, I got to say, I know we're supposed to be objective and neutral. That's a little disappointing. I was very excited about the possibility of the bison
Chad Pergracki is one of those guys that has these big ideas. And it's not impossible, but I can certainly understand the bridge team explained why this particular alignment and geographic location is the most cost effective. It's best for not having very many homes and businesses relocated.
Sure.
And, you know, they don't have to get a whole bunch of new right of way, because the second lanes, you know, the second bridge will be built right where the existing bridge is. So all the ramps and everything will be relatively close to where the existing ones are.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. You don't want to reroute an entire interstate for the sake of potentially doing something like this.
Yeah. Well, and that's not to say that there couldn't be some continued plan for a state park or a national park that included bison. The bison just would not be traveling back and forth between Iowa and Illinois. Honestly, there aren't bison here
right
now.
Yeah.
You know, they would be moving a herd here.
Interesting. Well, again, we'll continue to follow that story. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are doing our Friday reporter roundtables. This week, we are focusing on the Quad Cities with Michelle O'Neill from WVIK, public radio station there, and the Metro East area, the Illinois side of the St. Louis metropolitan area, with Will Bauer, who covers that region for KWMU, St. Louis Public Radio. And Will, Southern Illinois University recently hosted an equity symposium, which included the Reverend Wheeler Parker. What can you tell us about him and that?
Yeah, so Reverend Wheeler Parker was the last living witness to Emmett Till's kidnapping. And he was Emmett Till's cousin, or still is Emmett Till's cousin. And he would also say the two were very good friends. They were best friends. And he kind of told the story of Emmett Till's kidnapping and what it was like for him, and kind of all the events that led up to the kidnapping and his murder from Wheeler Parker's perspective. So back in 1955, the two and some other family members were down in Mississippi visiting. They were from the Chicagoland area, and they were at a store, and they are kind of many conflicting accounts of what happened. Some say that Emmett Till touched the white woman. Carolyn Bryant's her name, who was working at the store. Reverend Wheeler Parker would say that Emmett didn't do that. He simply wolf whistled at her. He did not touch her. So Till was 14 at the time, and Parker said that his cousin was a jokester, and he really just truly didn't understand what he had done in that moment. And one of the quotes that kind of stuck out to me from this discussion from Reverend Wheeler Parker was, quote, in 1955 in Mississippi, and you wolf whistle at a white woman, that's death. So after that happened, the group left, and it would be a few days later that two white men, one of them was the husband of the woman who was working, kidnapped Emmett Till. And Reverend Parker is the last living witness to Emmett Till, because he was in the home where Till was abducted. And so, of course, Emmett Till very infamously was viciously tortured and beaten to death. The two men accused did stand trial, but were acquitted and not convicted. And Till's death was, you know, very much a watershed moment for the civil rights movement here in America. And so at the end of Reverend Wheeler Parker's remarks, he had said that he'd wished Carolyn Bryant, the woman who Till whistled at, would have set the record straight before she had died, actually earlier this year. And he also said another thing that kind of stood out to me, and he repeated it a few times through his discussion, was that his story wasn't a pleasant story. It wasn't a pretty story by any means, but it was an American story, and that it was one that needed to be told.
One that needed to be told, and you can actually learn about it at the National Museum of American History as well. And we have some tape of Reverend Parker talking about the moment when the two white men broke into the house and kidnapped Emmett Till. Let's listen to that.
Went to bed, went to sleep, and I remember very vividly being wakened by people talking. They said, you got two boys here from Chicago, and we want to talk to the one who did the talking at the store. Not whistling, talking. And I immediately said, God, these people are getting ready to kill us. We're getting ready to die. Now, I heard the stories. My uncle told a story about how they hung two people down the street. And you knew you were very helpless, and you couldn't call. It's hard to believe that they lived in America, and you couldn't call anybody for help. You couldn't call the police. I mean, that's a very helpless feeling. It's pure terror. And I started praying, because we were very religious. As far as I was concerned, death was imminent.
So, Will, what message did he want to leave people with? You mentioned history is important, this history, it's American history, to sort of face the unpleasantness, I guess, in our past?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely why he goes around and he tells this story, is that it was a completely different world back in the 1955s, especially in the South, right? Right. And he may... they may have been able to exist completely differently in Chicago, but 14-year-old Emmett Till had no idea that his family had come from the South. Well, he knew that his family had come from the South, but he didn't understand that his actions in that moment, it was a completely different world down there. And so when he did what he did, it was death, like Reverend Parker said. So Reverend Parker would also say that progress has been made, but by all means, all these problems are still not solved, and work still needs to be done.
Definitely. Thank you for sharing that, Will. Michelle, I want to come back to you, and this may be the last thing we have time to talk about, just a couple of minutes left in our conversation. But you know, one of the unique things about the Quad Cities, it's really kind of its own area because of its connection to Iowa compared to the rest of Illinois. And that means you get to see presidential candidates coming through your communities,
which right.
Most of us do not, or I guess get to is one perspective on it. But you did have Republican presidential candidate Ron DeSantis campaigning in your area. What did he have to say?
Yes, he came and he campaigned at a restaurant in Davenport, Iowa, called the Iowa Machine Shed. And that is a place where I have covered presidential candidates in the past, mostly GOP candidates. So he came there and, you know, had a pretty good crowd. It was the day after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds endorsed DeSantis. And that was a fairly big deal, you know, just because Trump has been spouting his criticism of both of them. You know, anyway, he talked initially about what was going on in the immediate past, of course, which is the war in Israel. And he was very adamant that he would deport college students with foreign visas who participate in these protests that are mainly sort of pro-Hamas. And so he talked about that. He said, you know, if you're a foreign student on a foreign visa, I'm sending you home and canceling your visa. So that, you know, is kind of an interesting perspective. And then he talks about, you know, investing more in fossil fuels, trying to cut inflation and making the whole country more energy independent. And then, you know, he defended his positions and decisions during COVID and, you know, pretty much criticized the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control, saying that, you know, he doesn't trust them anymore. You know, so he took a lot of flack for that during the COVID pandemic. And, you know, it's really ramping up here. You know,
a couple of months ago, he moved
about a third of his campaign staff to Iowa. And like, you know, Trump is coming in a couple of weeks to Coralville, Iowa, which is right by Iowa City, home of the University of Iowa. So
interesting. Well, you get to or have to cover these things.
You can decide for yourself.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Michelle O'Neill from WVIK, Will Bauer with St. Louis Public Radio. That's all the time we have for our political roundtable or our news roundtable. We'll be turning to politics in a moment. Stay with us.